committee meeting today, and let it be noted there are five of us, which makes a quorum, so we can actually do some business. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3451, and I'm going to invite the Secretary of State, Mr. Pack, up just to ask a couple questions. We had some concerns about this bill previously. We would like to make sure that we have those things answered. We don't have the fiscal right now, so we are not going to move the bill until then, but I think we will move the amendments in. I don't think we've done that yet, so we will probably do that in a moment. But first, many of the people had concerns about the process. We understand that for one of the vendors that we have out there that do ballots, we basically already have the ability to do this because it's secure. Can you assure us that the other vendors can be worked out in such a way that they can be secure, so there's no accidental way of people knowing the outcome of a ballot if we were to have it run through the machine early, not actually any numbers? So I'll leave it to you to convince us that there is a process that's similar to the other vendor that would allow us to do that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State. Yes, the short answer is yes. The longer answer is that we've had a lot of conversations with the county clerks, with the vendor for the ESNS system, which is where the vast majority of our counties use to scan and tally their ballots. We've witnessed a demonstration of some workarounds from the vendor that will help us assure that while the ballots are being scanned and the votes are tallied, no one will be able to access that tally until Election Day, when they are allowed under current statute to access the tally, that we will be able to put in place systems that will demonstrate and log that the appropriate security procedures were in place prior to the beginning of scanning of ballots, and that they have not been compromised up through the day in which, up until Election Day, when those security procedures would be removed and the counties would be able to scan and tally ballots as they do today. So while I can't say 100% absolutely never ever going to happen, because that would really be realistic and appropriate, but I do feel that with all the conversations and the brainstorming we've had, we are confident that each county will be able, who wants to scan early, and again, not all of them will, but the larger counties and high turnout elections would want to, that we'll be able to have some security procedures in place that prevent access to the tally.
Well, Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Barry, you said the ESNS system, you have seen a demonstration, you're confident that that can be accomplished. That's, if I remember right, 32 of 36 counties, or 34 of...
4 of 36, correct. 36. Veterans, yes.
There's also the HART system, which already was secure. What about the Sequoia system used in Lane County?
Yeah, can we...
Yes, please, come on up.
Since it's specific to Lane County, Representative Edwards.
Excuse me. Annette Newingham, Lane County Clerk. The Sequoia system has it's separate. The ballot process, when the ballots go through the ballot scanners, it does not show election results. They actually have to go from the console, a separate, totally different report. It's a different software. It's a different system that they actually have to run in order to get reports that say how many votes each person gets, and that's not done until just before we publish for the 8 p.m.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, each security plan that the counties would submit obviously have to be individualized to the facility and the needs of the county. So while we're talking about broad general terms around procedures, they'll have to be individualized for each facility in each county.
And a follow-up, Representative Edwards.
Thank you. And so clarification, this bill, if gives the Secretary of State authority not to approve a plan if you don't have the confidence that the security is in place, then you have the authority to say, nope, whatever county can't do it.
Chair Rivlin, Representative Edwards, yes, the Dash 1 amendments only allow a county to scan their ballots early if the Secretary of State has approved a security plan. And we would take that responsibility very, very seriously.
Thank you.
Any other questions? And that's the Dash 1s or the Dash 2? Dash 1s. Okay. And we have not yet put the Dash 1s into this bill. Is that correct?
We have not moved the Dash 1s yet.
Okay. So we are in work session. I would accept a motion to move the Dash 1s.
Mr. Chair, are you looking for a motion on the Dash 1s dated 4-1-09?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments dated 4-1-09 into House Bill 3451.
Representative Edwards has moved that amendments to House Bill 3451, the Dash 1s, dated 4-1-09. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. So the Dash 1s are in place. We don't have the physical or the yet, so we're waiting for that one. So with that, we're going to leave this open, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2867 at the same public hearing, did I say? Hopefully. Public hearing on House Bill 2867. And with that, we'll have a short explanation from our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 2867 requires contracting agencies before entering into a public contract to establish measurable standards to assess the quality of the contractor's performance and clear consequences for failing to meet those standards, outlines examples of criteria to develop measurable standards, authorizes the Secretary of State and local contracting agencies to audit public contracts, establishes certain standards for audits, prohibits a contracting agency from contracting for the administration of contracts except for hiring a consultant to train contracting agency employees in skills necessary for administration. Prohibits an employee of a contracting agency from seeking or obtaining employment with a contractor in certain circumstances. Requires a contractor to offer employment to an employee of a contracting agency if, due to the terms of the public contract, the employee is displaced. Requires a contracting agency before conducting a procurement for goods and services with an estimated contract price that exceeds $25,000 to demonstrate with cost analysis or by other means that the cost of providing goods or performing services with a contracting agency's own personnel or resources is greater than the cost of procuring goods or services from the contractor. Specifies additional criteria for contracting agency to use in determining the contractor's responsibility and for pre-qualifying the contractor. Declares an emergency. It's effective on passage. There is a proposed Dash 4 amendment that should be in your files accompanying this bill. House Bill 2867 applies to public contracts that first advertised, otherwise solicited, or entered into or renewed on or after January 1, 2010. Examples of additional criteria for the contracting agency to use in determining the contractor's responsibility and pre-qualifying the contractor include the demonstration that the bidder is not in current litigation, subject to administrative action, or otherwise in a legal dispute with another contracting agency or public agency in another state. Requires that a contracting agency review eligibility for pre-qualification 3 years after the contracting agency's initial decision to pre-qualify the bidder, and verifies the bidder responsibility at each end of each subsequent 3-year period.
Thank you very much. So just so committee understands, this is a bill that came to us from another committee, and there had been many discussions, much work. That brings us the Dash 4 amendments, some of the work that had been done to that point. And what I'm hoping to do today is to get on the record and start that conversation here. I see personally there are things that I think we can do in this bill, I want us to get caught up to speed as to what we're really talking about, the amendments, and I think we have people here that can talk to that, and issues that are about this bill as it moves forward. So the issue today is to get a clear idea amongst us about what is really here. And with that, I will invite Melissa Unger. Is it Lana Young from ODOT? And Gordon Lafer from LERC.
Do you want to go through this one? I think we just lost you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today. And so, and for the record, my name is Melissa Unger, and I represent SEIU Local 503. And today we bring with you the House Bill 2867 with the -4 amendments. And the bill that was, I think, briefly described is broader than what we've narrowed down to the -4 amendments. But I want to give you a little bit of background about where we are. And before I start, I do want to say that we continue to be in the cycle with this bill where we get the amendments back about, 2 days before the hearing. So I think we continue to have a difficult time getting feedback about what are some of the issues. That some of them are legitimate issues with the way the bill's written or little things. And so hopefully today during the hearing we can get some of we can learn more about that because a lot of people just got the amendments. And we just got the amendments on Friday afternoon. And so people continue to, I think, try to figure out what they do and how we can make them work. But at the beginning of session, our coalition, and the coalition, if you look at, I think, in the materials I just handed to you, there's a fact sheet, and it lists off all the groups that we've been working with together on this bill, brought forward two bills, one that dealt with transparency of public contracts, and then House Bill 2867. And as Representative Roblin indicated, we had a hearing in Business and Labor, so thank you, Representative Chris Edwards, for sitting through it twice. We had a hearing in Business and Labor, and we were put into a work group where we had one meeting. And in that meeting, I think we were able to figure out some of the broader issues that were being raised and concerns about the broadness of the bill that we were able to address. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say that we've addressed all of the issues because I don't think that we have. And I also think that there's also some legitimate, probably just a disagreement on whether the policy is something that we want to do. And so I think there's some very legitimate issues about how to create a process that works in our contracting laws. And we want to make sure that we are creating a process that works in our contracting laws. But to give you our transparency bill was merged into House Bill 2500. And I kind of want to first tell you a little bit about why our members prioritize this bill. They've come to a reality that public services are provided by public employees and private contractors, and we want to make sure that the laws and the transparency reflect that. There's a perception that contracting saves money, but our members every day on the job find that sometimes contracting is much more expensive than providing the work in-house, and they don't quite understand how that decision-making process happens. And lastly, they are concerned that sometimes contractors are not held to the same quality standard that they feel that they're held to. And so in this, I just want to make it clear that our goal is to ensure that contracting is done in a way that requires high quality standards, that's cost efficient, and doesn't undercut people's wages and benefits. The -4 amendments do 4 things. They create a process for a cost analysis for service contracts. It ensures that all agencies have clear scopes of work written into service contracts that hold contractors to industry standards. It ensures that inspectors and surveyors of construction contracts are independent of the contractors performing the work. And it expands the responsible bidder guidelines to ensure that contractors have a satisfactory record of performance. Those are the 4 things that the amendments now do. There are going to be a couple of different people who will testify about different pieces of those 4 things. I want to focus on, I think, the 2 broadest reforms, which are the cost analysis and the responsible bidder guidelines. The cost analysis is not an idea that we necessarily created on our own. but it was actually suggested, and it was through research, that a cost-benefit analysis is suggested by the National State Auditors Association as a best contracting process. And also, and we found in the Multnomah County audit of large contracts that the audit performed in Multnomah County found that the county's decision to contract was not necessarily deliberate or documented. And so one of the goals of the cost analysis is to make sure that the decision to contract is deliberate, documented, and affordable. The cost analysis has changed significantly since it was first proposed. We originally proposed that a cost analysis be performed on all service contracts over $25,000, and now we have raised that to $150,000 after a lot of conversations with agencies about what's actually realistic. Another concern was that sometimes it's just not feasible to do work in-house. I believe ODOT actually brought up the example that creating licenses is not feasible to do in-house. So how do we make sure that we're not doing a cost analysis on things that, you know, we're not going to ever do in-house? And so there, we changed the cost analysis to start off with a feasibility study to determine if it's feasible. And so in the bill, it allows, if, you know, if you don't have the needed expertise, if it only lasts for 3 months, if it's, you know, not, you know, it's actually just not feasible to do the work in-house, and then you don't have to do a cost analysis, you just do the feasibility study. But if it determines that it is feasible to do the work in-house or to contract it out, that then you would perform a cost analysis to determine what is the best way to proceed. And so, and then in the cost analysis, it says that if, you know, in the end, it turns out that to do the work in-house is the cheaper option, then you would do the work in-house. If it says that the, but it also has a, I like to call it a cost analysis with a wage standard. If the sole reason it is cheaper to contract is because of lower wages and benefits, and it says the sole reason in the bill, then agencies shouldn't contract. It should not be the policy that we contract to undercut trained employees' wages and benefits. And instead, our position is that contracting should be used to increase efficiency, get expertise that we wouldn't otherwise have, increase quality, perform short-term projects, and use outside resources to improve government, and not to contract out family wage jobs. And so that's kind of the big piece of the cost analysis, and I think that the biggest change that we've made is this idea that you first make sure that you determine whether it's actually feasible to do the work in-house, and if it's not feasible to do the work in-house, then you continue to contract, and you don't have to do a cost analysis. And so that was to really take into consideration some of the feedback we got from agencies. And we continue to be talking to agencies about other pieces of the bill that we need to resolve. And one of those unresolved issues in the bill that was raised to us on Friday that I actually thought was very useful feedback was a problem sometimes caused by a lack of position authority. So sometimes agencies want to do the work in-house. It is cheaper to do the work in-house, but they don't have the position authority to do the work in-house. And this was raised as a concern about what would you do if you got to the end of the cost analysis. It determined that you should do the work in-house because it's more cost-effective, but you don't have the positions to do the work in-house. And so sometimes if an agency can be forced to contract out work that would be cheaper because they don't have the position authority. And so we're hoping to work with the agencies to come up with a solution to that problem, because I don't think we're trying to create a problem where if they don't have the position authority, they can't do the work. And so what is the solution to that problem? And I think a piece of that may be a report to the legislature or something of that sort to say, if you don't have the position authority but it's cheaper, we would want to work on that and make sure that we're getting the position so that you can do the work most cost effectively. In the end, I believe that, you know, our organization believes that performing a cost analysis will save money. So just one example is ODOT IT contracts. An SEIU's contract that we have with the state, agencies must report when they're contracting jobs that would otherwise be performed by SEIU employees, so they have to give us a report about that. And over the last 21 months, we've received 70 reports from ODOT regarding IT contracts that they're planning on contracting out. The agency has estimated that it would have cost a little over $7 million to perform the work with agency staff, but it cost $15 million to contract the work. By the agency's own estimation, it costs 106% more to contract the work. Now, I want to be clear that some of these contracts were because they didn't have the expertise on staff to do the work. And that, in that situation, they would continue to be able to contract under this bill. And some of these contracts were for under $150,000, so you wouldn't do a cost analysis on those either. But I do believe that some of them would fall under this situation where you would do a cost analysis and you would figure out if it was cheaper to perform the work in-house. And if it's an issue of position authority, hopefully we can come to a resolution so that we can be providing these services to the highest quality and most cost-effectively. And I also want to, the other piece of the bill that I would like to talk about is the responsible bidder guidelines. I think one of the pieces about this bill that is slightly confusing is that it relates to two different statutes in contracting code. The cost analysis does not deal with construction contracts at all. It is just for personal service contracts. It's only in 279B, which refers to personal service contracts. At the end of the bill, there's, the responsible bidder guidelines that do deal with construction contracts. So I think that's just an important clarification. I want to thank all the groups who have continued to talk with us about this bill, and that includes AGC and the building trades who have worked with us on some of this responsible bidder guidelines and how we get language that actually works and gets at what we're trying to get to. Our goal here is to ensure that there's language in the responsible bidder part of the statute that gives agencies the tools they need to work with the contractors that perform the best services. So currently in the bill, we've expanded the definition of satisfactory record of performance to ensure that agencies can look at past performance in terms of cost overruns and timeline overruns that were specifically the fault of the contractor. So we understand that sometimes there's times where you go over timeline or you go over bid because the information from the agency or the agency has caused that to happen. But to look at specifically what was in the control of the contractor. And we believe that if a contractor is coming in over bid and over time and it's their fault, that should be considered when they're continuing to get new contracts. The other thing we do is we expand the definition of integrity. The language that we have suggested says that if a contractor has a previous criminal conviction for offenses relating to obtaining a contract, that should be taken into consideration when determining their integrity. And with recent examples such as the Ross brothers who bet each other that they could get the state to pay for services they didn't do, we want our laws to ensure that contractors, you know, who are actually gaming the system don't continue to get contracts, but that contractors who are actually very quality contracts do continue to get contractors. We are working with ODOT on one change they would like to see to that piece, ensuring that they can look at things beyond just criminal convictions as well. And that was just a language piece in that part of the bill. Now, I'd like to believe that our amendments cleared up some of the confusion of our first bill. I don't think that it's cleared up all of the confusion of our first bill, but we have worked to really deal with some of the larger issues. I think now that we have these amendments, we're able to talk about some of the specifics about how this will work and how this might not work. But at a time when we're trying to save money and we are going to be laying off hundreds to thousands of state workers, we need to make sure that we're making the wisest decisions with our dollars. The state does over $4 billion worth of contracting, not even including highway construction, every biennium. And we need policies such as this to ensure that we're making the right decisions with our dollars and that we're holding contractors to the highest quality standards, just as I think we do with the rest of state government. So that's kind of a little bit of background on the bill and to walk you through how we got here, but I'm open to any questions that you have regarding all of that, or if there's other parts of the amendments that you'd like clarification on.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Melissa, what part of the bill is the responsible bidder?
I believe, Chair Roblin, Representative Edwards, I believe it's section 7 and 9.
Seven, okay.
Section 7 is the one that relates to 279B, and Section 9 is the one that relates to 279C, since they're separate in the two different spaces.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Yeah.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Berger.
Excuse me if this is the first time I've heard this bill. Did the Business and Labor Committee have a series of hearings on this bill?
Chair Roblin, Representative Berger, they had one hearing on this bill, and there was actually two bills, and I think that there was more time discussed regarding the first transparency bill. We did have one work group meeting, a couple-hour work group meeting, regarding the bills to try to get some of the issues out on the table. It was then referred to rules because the transparency conversation was merged with House Bill 2500, and so because that conversation had been happening together, it just kind of made more sense, and to be able to spend the time on this bill to fix out some of the kinks, it was moved to this bill. So there was one hearing on the bill and then a work group session.
Further question, the dash four amendments are a result of that work group?
Chair Roblin, Representative Berger, they're a result of a variety of conversations, and so they come from a lot of suggestions made in the work group. They also come from individual conversations that we were able to have with agencies, individual conversations we were able to have with the building trades and AGC. One day, the City of Portland spent some time on the phone with me to kind of try to walk through the process. And so it was a variety of conversations and talking about the different concerns with the bill that brought forward the Dash 4 amendments. Like I say, I don't think that they've figured out all of the problems or all of the kinks in the system to make sure it works with contracting laws, but I think that the general outline of what is, how are we making decisions to contract, and how does that work within those conversations? And so, for instance, we increased the $150,000 was increased because that made the most sense in the contracting process, the feasibility study, things of the sort.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I guess I'm going to ask a short question, and then hopefully it will help some of the other things I'm hearing. You kind of alluded to part of the reason why we need this bill at all in the beginning, but could you clearly and succinctly point out the why you believe it is important to have these issues codified in law, different from what we have today?
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you for that question. The simplest way is because we need to ensure accountability in the system, and when we're deciding to contract or keep work in-house, how is that decision to be being made to ensure that we're providing services to the highest quality standards and cost efficiently? And that's basically the base reason. But the other reason is to ensure that public services are provided by private contractors and public employees. And how are we ensuring that our laws reflect that, and that those decisions are being made deliberately, and that they're documented, and that people can be a part of that decision-making process?
So for me, having been on different places making big contracts, I know how difficult it was on our water board to get the standards we wanted to have in place to pick the contractor we thought could build the dam that was going to last through the earthquake. I mean, that was very important to us. We were going to build a new dam, and we wanted it to survive a large subduction zone earthquake. And so our attorneys spent a lot of time trying to figure out what standards do we put in the contract to make sure that the person who we're going to give it to was not the low bidder, but rather the person who could actually build the dam that was going to be there. We were able to do it, but it was really kind of interesting how nervous the board was when we ended up selecting a person, a contractor, who was not the low bid, and wonder if we were going to survive challenges to that. And so for me, I think clearly stating that there are other standards by which we evaluate a contract that have equal standing with that, so that you get what you wanted. And in our county, we've had two of those things. One was the building of a gas pipeline, which resulted in lawsuits and lots of things. Low bid was taken. It created a lot of problems, and it was a 2-1 vote. And a dam that got built that no one ever complained, and it got built on time, on cost, and it's a remarkable deal. So having appropriate standards is important to me. I guess that I just wanted to make that statement, because I think there is something to be done here. So, Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, from her, and that's why I asked
right. How
many hearings of this has had, because I feel like I'm walking into the middle of a conversation that I didn't get the beginning of. But I noticed that this bill is sponsored by the committee on, and I guess what I understood from sort of the thrust of your testimony, this bill is about what we do up front to first determine whether we're going to contract at all.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fair assumption? So what
yes.
you're basically doing is putting a feasibility study and a cost analysis ahead of any contracting at all.
Representative Berger, it is. How do you make that decision to contract? Yes.
And that is a policy change from that is embedded in this bill that is the fundamental piece?
Chair Roblin, Representative Berger, I think it depends on which agency you talk to and which local government and who. Some, I think, make those decisions and do some of that now. I think others don't.
And this would apply, Mr. Chair, if I could pursue this,
please.
To all public contracts, local government, state government, everybody under the sun.
Chair Roblin, Representative Berger, it would apply to all personal service contracts over $150,000 to all local all contracting agencies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And that's why we're having this hearing, to get us kind of up to speed, because I agreed we needed to get up to speed. Okay. Thank you. And we also have a person we're going to call by phone. Is that right?
Okay. Yes, Chair Roblin.
And we'll do that right after we hear from.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. I'm Lorna Youngs, Deputy Director for Central Services at ODOT. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2867. These amendments make several changes to the contracting process. And we had quite a few concerns about the original language of the bill. Most of those, to a large extent, are addressed by the Dash 4 amendments. And as Ms. Unger alluded, we've only seen those rather recently, so if I'm a little bit off in my testimony, it is as a result of that. But she did point out one of our major concerns in relationship to the finding, allowing the agency to contract out when it's not clearly feasible. One of the reasons that was not listed in the bill, as she pointed out, was when you simply do not have the personnel to do the work. You've got the expertise, you just don't simply have enough of those individuals to do so, and there is no provision in the bill for that, because it has been much of the philosophy and practice of the legislature when more resources are needed to provide personal services dollars rather than additional FTE. So that's one concern that we have with the current language of the Dash 4 amendments. There's another section, and this may have to do with my lack of understanding of the bill, but it requires that unless the contracting agency for good cause specifies otherwise, the scope of work shall require the contractor to meet the highest standards prevalent in the industry. And it's not entirely clear what will be the good cause test, and we're not sure whether goods are still included in this section, so we're not quite sure how the test might be applied to goods, and in many cases, the highest quality is not needed for a good. Remember the archives carpet, as an example. So we just want a little clarification whether what's the test for good cause, and are goods still included in that test? As Ms. Unger alluded, both Sections 7 and Section 9, in speaking to the contractor's record of integrity, speak primarily to whether or not they've had a previous criminal convictions. We're proposing that you add the words among other things, and that would allow the agency to also consider whether they have a prior history of civil litigations for failure to for bully complaints, for suits against them for failing to pay their subcontractors. So we think the language there ought to be a little broader, and the way in which we see this is that there's already a requirement for integrity. What the bill is doing is simply spelling out criteria one can use to determine integrity. The bill will carry a fiscal impact for agencies. We average more than 40 personal services contracts per month above the $150,000 limit. Now, I'm not entirely sure, given the testimony that the cost analysis only applies to 279B, whether or not all of the 40 fall under that. I'd have to go back and do some quick analysis of that. So, but there will be a fiscal impact. So we look forward to the opportunity to continue to work with the committee and the proponents of the bill to make sure that you achieve your goals of improving the contracting process, but you do so in a practical and fiscally prudent fashion. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, and I'll be happy to entertain any questions that I can answer, not being a contracting expert.
Any questions? Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Youngs, when you develop your proposal, your proposed budget as an agency, do you now go through an analysis of what the most cost-effective way of achieving your projects is as compared between in-house and contracted services, or personnel in particular?
Chair Roblin, Representative Nolan, no, we do not do that kind of analysis in preparing the budget in terms of what would it cost us to do, because for one, construction is done outside, obviously. So, and a great deal of our work is done through contracting out. So we don't do a standard analysis of whether or not we should contract out or not for all the work that we do. We move forward the FTE. If we have additional resource needs for a specific project, we have asked for those in the past. Not always been very successful. So usually my experience has been we've been more successful in getting personal services dollars for IT work, for example, than we have been getting personnel.
If I might follow up.
Please.
Are there areas where you think the premise of this bill applies to ODOT's work? And by the premise of this bill, I mean that there are types of work or types of projects that can be achieved more economically on behalf of the taxpayers through the use of in-house staff than through contracted labor? Or do you think this doesn't apply to any of the work that you do?
Chair Roblin, Representative Nolan, I'm sure the bill applies to us in that.
So may I follow up then? So then, for example, when all state agencies recently had an opportunity to identify ways to reduce their costs by up to 30%, did you identify any projects that you might do in-house instead of through contracted labor in order to meet that reduction?
Chair Roblin, Representative Nolan, we did not participate in that 30% reduction exercise because ODOT is other-funded and we're not required or we're asked to participate in that exercise.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking for clarification. I think I know what the answer is, but I'd like clarification. It sounds, does this bill applies to all contracting, whether it's the decision to contract something that hasn't customarily been contracted, or if it's existing contracting that happens now, something that's clearly been customary within the agency? I mean, even if it was just the last, you know, biennium or the last couple of biennia, it's been customary to contract out a particular service. This bill would apply to those services as well that are already being contracted out, but would essentially become an evaluation tool on existing contracts.
Yeah, Chair Roblin, Representative Edwards. I think that's technically true, but to be clear, it's only on personal service contracts, and I just keep saying that because I think there's been so much confusion about that, and that it would definitely be at renewal of a contract that this would happen. Right now, with the way it's written into the bill, it's actually one thing that I think has been brought up to us on how do we want to take that into consideration of things that have been customarily contracted, and I think that that's a conversation. But I think that the piece of what you just said is that, yes, it would be a tool that when they're renewed to be able to go through this process, but if it's been contracted because it's not feasible to do in-house, then you would assume that some of that would not, you wouldn't step to the cost analysis because after the feasibility study would be done, you would assume that it's not feasible to do in-house, which was why we put the feasibility study as a part of the bill. And so that people, you know, if it's not feasible to do in-house, then we shouldn't waste resources doing a cost analysis. And the feasibility piece is in Section 4 of the bill.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you define personal services contracts for the purposes of this bill?
Chair Roblin, Representative Berger, I don't know if I'm the best person to define personal service contracts.
But if someone else has the definition, that's fine. I don't want to put you on the spot, but that's a question that comes flying into my mind.
Chair Roblin, Representative Berger, I know there is someone here who can help define that, but I mean, it's a broad definition, so it includes janitorial contracts as well as IT contracts. It's, you know, the definition is decently broad about what kind of contracts, but it is people, is one of the people performing the service.
Okay.
But I will get you the right definition.
Well, someone.
So we're going to make a phone call right now and get a hold of Gordon Laffer. Hi, Gordon. This is Representative Arne Roblin in Salem, and we're here having a conversation about House Bill 2867.
Yes.
And so you're up. So we'll let you do your testimony. Hopefully you can hear everybody. We'll have some questions for you, and then we'll go from there.
My name is Gordon Laffer. I'm a professor and acting director of the University of Oregon's Labor Education and Research Center, and I've been studying issues of economic policy for more than two decades. Specifically, over the last 5 years, I've conducted a number of studies on the economics of contracting out, on the one hand, school support services, transportation, custodial, and food services in Oregon schools, and on the other hand, contracting out architectural and design services involved in the construction of highway and bridge projects for the Oregon Department of Transportation. These are quite different areas, the school services on the one hand and building bridges and highways on the other hand, but in both cases the research found evidence of significant problems that I think HB 2867 could shed important light on. And I'm not going to go through all of my written statements, but I want to focus on two particular things that I think are relevant to the legislation you're considering, which is the importance of requiring real cost-benefit analysis is one, and the other is the importance of having contracts clearly define the scope of work that will be provided by the contractor. So first on cost-benefit analysis, I want to talk about two examples. The first is the cost of doing architectural and engineering design work for highways and bridges. Whenever contracting out is done, it's generally done on the assumption that it's going to save taxpayers money, but surprisingly, there's very often not a rigorous cost-benefit analysis done beforehand. I did the first systematic analysis of the cost of contracting out design work for the construction of bridges in the state. A lot of that work has been contracted out by ODOT, and I've got information from ODOT covering all bridges constructed in the period 1997 to 2008. When the data were cleaned up, we were able to get clean data on 72% of those bridges. And what I looked at is that for every $1,000 spent on bridge construction, on actual bridge construction, in-house ODOT engineers could do the design work for $74. By contrast, when the work went outside, $1,000 worth of bridge construction cost $125 instead of $74 to be designed by private consultants, which is nearly two-thirds more expensive. Because a tremendous amount of money obviously is spent on these are big-dollar infrastructure projects, over the whole period from 1997 to 2008, the money lost by sending the work outside, the work that went outside, amounted to over $27 million. That's money that could have been saved by the state if all that work had been done inside. And that's only the savings that apply to those 72% of the bridge projects for which we could get clean data and not looking at the highway projects at all. So certainly if those other projects were included, the number would be even higher. And as we go forward, you know, clearly one of the big areas that there is going to continue to be public spending on is infrastructure construction projects. So this seems like a particularly important area to be careful about making sure that if work is going to be contracted out, we know ahead of time clearly what the costs and benefits are going to be. A second thing that I looked at in school services and found a surprise on in terms of cost-benefit analysis is the contracting out of school transportation services. And one of these cases I looked at was in the Lake Oswego School District, which did a multi-part deal that involved selling off the fleet of the previous fleet of school buses and then having the school district purchase a very large new fleet that became the private property of the Laidlaw Transportation Company that had the right to use those buses any place in the state, in other school districts, or even for for-profit uses outside of the school day. State policy is that the state reimburses 70% of the cost of bus purchases only when the buses are actually owned by a district. In this case, the cost of buying the buses was folded into the per-mile charge that they charged the district and was sent to the state for reimbursement, and the state reimbursed 70%. So the school district declared that contracting out was going to be a big cost savings because it only counted the cost to the school district itself and didn't count this huge cost, the 70% of the cost of buying a whole fleet of Laidlaw buses that was paid for by the state. If there was a requirement for a serious cost-benefit analysis that would have included all the cost funded out of state tax dollars as well as local school district tax dollars, what was presented as a savings would have been revealed to be a large loss by privatization. So again, the districts can decide whatever they want, but having clear information about where we're really saving money for taxpayers and where we're losing money would make a big difference in that decision. The second point I wanted to touch on is I think the need for very clear definitions of what the public agency is getting when it contracts out services. Because any cost-benefit analysis, obviously, what you hope is that it's done on an apples-to-apples basis. People have in their heads that we're getting cheaper service, we're getting the same service for cheaper when we contract out. Unfortunately, that's often not true, and often it's hard to tell because the contract doesn't include a clear definition of the standards. One of the most troubling examples of this I found was in Lincoln County, where the school district contracted out custodial services to Sodexo, a large multinational company. And rather than making clear what Sodexo had to do, written into the contract was a clause that said that after Sodexo was awarded the contract, then it would have the right to say what its scope of service should be. It said, quote, following award of the contract, the contractor shall conduct a service study and provide a thorough and comprehensive analysis of proposed service standards and specifications. So the contract was given first, and then the contractor was allowed to essentially write their own job description. In addition, the contractor was told after they won the contract that they should come up with a staffing model, an operational model, a methodology for verifying whether they've complied with the standards that they created, and some method of adjusting to see if those standards are not met. So they were supposed to write their own job description, write their own plan for how to tell if they met that or not, and tell themselves what the punishment should be if they didn't meet those. So having none of these things specified in the contract and all of them in the hands of the contractor makes it just impossible for a public agency to know what you're getting in return for the contract. In this case, the final kicker of the story was that, in fact, none of this was ever done. Sodexo never wrote its standards of what it should have to do. It never wrote a method for measuring it, and it never came up with a model for how much they should be penalized financially if they didn't meet them. So in both cases, whether in any individual case a public agency decides to contract out services, from our research, showed up very clear reasons why we should insist on there being clear cost-benefit analysis and also clear definition of what it is a contractor is to provide. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions for this witness? I think we have copies of your materials. I appreciate that. But I'm not seeing a whole lot of questions currently. And just so you know, this was, and you probably did know, this was in a different committee. We're trying to get up to speed as to where we are as we move forward. So I thank you for your information.
Thank you very much. That's for the flexibility of allowing me to testify by phone. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye. We have a fairly long list of people who wish to testify for this bill, pros and cons, and so we've heard kind of the beginnings of that. I'm going to switch to a few of the people who have said that they are against, so we get some other questions, then we'll go back to some people who are in favor. I think that will give us a clearer idea of how, for all of us on this committee, where we're at on this bill. And the other issue that I could bring to you right now, do you have to leave a little early? You're pretty good. Okay.
What is today, Monday?
Yeah.
Oh, I do. Thank you.
Because I need to find out if we want to. We have an open hearing right now. We were waiting to make sure we had enough people here to vote on our other bill, and we could take a break and do that real quickly.
We have enough?
Well, let's go our next round, and then we'll see. I think we're
pretty close.
So, Jeff Baer from the City of Portland, Mike Eelson from the Association of Oregon Counties, and Mark, is it Landau? Landauer. Oh. Okay, we're good.
I'm not staying. I need to leave by 4:30.
We'll make sure we do it before that.
Business and
go right ahead and thank you.
Thank you for inviting me, Chair Roland, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you to get today regarding Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2867. And for the record, I'm Jeff Baer. I'm the Director of the Bureau of Purchases for the City of Portland and want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak before the committee on these amendments. The proposed amendments appear to prefer public employees perform work rather than have the services contract out if the cost is to be less. And however, there are several issues that do need further clarification. First, when you're looking at determining the city's cost, the cost of having public employees perform the work, the bill excludes overhead costs for administrators or for rent, equipment, utilities, except to the extent that they are attributable solely to performing the services and would not exist if the contracting agency did not perform the services. The bill seeks to really focus on incremental cost incurred in performing work, not on the true cost of keeping the work in-house. And real costs include some portion of cost associated with supervision and utilities. And the problem is whether the city is supposed to exclude these costs on a case-by-case basis or whether the city can truly analyze all the work that is kept in-house. And with this, the amendments provide no real guidance in this particular area. And also, when you turn to looking at the contractor's cost, it fails to really establish how the city is to determine the cost of estimating cost to a potential contractor for purposes of the required comparison. And the city may not have the expertise to really know how those costs are arrived at, nor would we really be able to obtain this information or provide it in a consistent manner. And the only way that sometimes we are able to determine these costs is to competitively bid these services out. And it appears that the bill requires this estimate to be done before this step can take place. So some of the questions that we're pondering is how would we be able to appropriately determine the costs related to such things as financing, taxes, bonding, legal services, and other related expenses required to comply with these statutory requirements. Some of the other questions that were looked at is what is the standard to which the comparison is to be held? Section 1 says the city must determine that performing the services in-house is not feasible. Section 4 states that the standard is clearly not feasible. So there's some difference in those terms? And how clear is clear? By what standard would a challenge of this be measured? Also, the cost comparison sections for both in-house and contracted work state what cost factors may be included. However, they don't prohibit the use of other cost factors. Are there some other areas related to special circumstances that the city can take into account? But are there other factors possible, or is this really exclusive? And how do the proposed amendments square with some of the requirements outlined in the collective bargaining agreements that may impose a different standard on the city for making this determination? Is it really the intent to preempt some of those contracts? So with that, I'll stop and address any questions you might have. Basically, we believe that this needs some further discussion and a lot more work. Thank you.
Thank you. questions now, or do you want to wait until we get... We'll wait for both of you, so go forward.
Thank you, Chair Rowland, members of the committee. Mark Landauer, representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon. At the outset, I'd like to express our association's support for and commitment to ensuring that public resources are spent wisely and that the public gets the greatest value for their tax dollar. However, our association would also like to express our opposition to 2867 as presently written, as well as the Dash 4 amendments. As Mr. Bayer expressed previously, and rightfully so, one of the problems with this bill is that it requires a public agency to conduct a cost analysis and compare that analysis to a private cost for the provision of services. It's very difficult, of course, for a public entity to know what the cost of that service will be without actually going through a bidding process, which creates an obvious problem for the public bodies in order to be able to even do that price comparison. So at the outset, there is a substantial problem with the bill. I would also like to mention that I participated in the work group conducted by Chair Schaffler when this bill was before the House Business and Labor Committee. However, since that time, we have not been notified of any work groups or meetings regarding this bill. And we are here now with the Dash 4 amendments, so I frankly was a little bit surprised to see how far along this bill has come. It certainly has made some improvements, but we have not been contacted at all to this point since that work group with Chair Schaffler. I'd also like to point out one other interesting topic with this bill. As you know, many of the districts that I represent are rather small and do not necessarily have the personnel or expertise to conduct some of the extensive, time-consuming, and rather expensive cost analyses that this amendment will require. What we may end up having to do, and I don't know if it was the intent of the bill sponsors, but we may end up having to contract out to actually conduct a cost analysis. And I don't think that that's necessarily the goal of the bill sponsors at this time. Finally, I'd just like to mention that this bill, as presently drafted, will be very expensive. We expect a substantial cost or fiscal impact to local government. Frankly, I haven't had the time to be able to gather those numbers at this point because I only got these amendments this morning, but would be happy to try to find out from some of our districts how much this would indeed cost. And finally, I'd be happy to answer any of your questions at this point.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark, you said that you don't have, many of your small districts don't have the staff to do a cost analysis. So could you explain to us how the contracting process would typically work then if you're not doing an analysis? Do you have a set of best practices of some sort that you that your districts do follow?
Yeah, well, indeed.
And what does that look like?
Chair Roblin and
Representative
Edwards. After every session, the Attorney General's office puts together what are called the model public contracting rules for the state of Oregon. Most of the districts that I represent adopt those model rules for public contracting, as do many other local governments throughout the state. There are some local governments, such as Portland, I believe, who do put together their own model rules, but for the most part, the Special Districts Association of Oregon follow the Attorney General's model rules that do spell out best practices.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The gentleman from Portland, I'm sorry, I don't remember your name.
Jeff.
Jeff, at the end of your remarks, you said that in some ways it's not clear how this would interface with collective bargaining agreements. Could you expand on that, what exactly you're getting at there?
Yes, Chair Rowland, Representative Berger, thank you.
what we were looking at in that regard was if we were to contract out those particular services and if it impeded upon a collective bargaining agreement, what sort of analysis would we have to do in terms of making sure that it did not cause an issue with the labor agreement and whether or not we'd even be able to contract out those services?
I thought it came.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions for this group of witnesses? Thank you very much.
One quick
and
one.
As, oh, wait,
Mr. Chair,
Representative
I'm sorry.
Nolan.
I understand that the threshold in this bill may be a bit problematic. It's a bit low. But I'm having a hard time understanding both of your assertions that your governing bodies have a tough time assessing what the cost estimate of projects is in order to make an initial judgment as to whether it makes more sense to go in-house or external. How do they ever make budget decisions? Doesn't someone make a cost estimate before a project is proposed to them for budgeting?
Yes. Chair Roblin, Representative Nolan, the issue that we do is related to obtaining the information from the private sector. If we were to do a true cost-benefit analysis, and under the way this is structured, we would have to obtain, it's very specific in terms of pricing, material, overhead, rent, insurance, and such, that we would have trouble obtaining from the private sector and able to use it for a cost analysis to compare with our internal cost.
I might follow up. When you have a capital improvement project, you have a capital improvement plan, someone estimates all of those things when they submit projects for that list. So I'm still having a hard time understanding what the mystery is.
Well, and if I may take a shot, sometimes those estimates, Chair Roblin, Representative Nolan, are wildly wrong. We have seen over the last couple of years, in fact, construction costs, and I realize we're talking about personnel services at the moment, but a good example would be where we saw construction costs going up by 10-20% on an annual basis, very quick escalation. More recently, as a result of the economy, we have seen substantial decreases in costs for construction. There are a lot of hungry contractors out there who want to do bidding. So as a result, you'll see prices fall. There are fluctuations in the market that are difficult to predict, and as a result, making these true cost comparisons really must be done, at least according to this bill, almost real time, because you don't know what those fluctuations are going to be.
Mm-hmm. One
follow-up.
Yeah.
Representative Nolan.
So is there a threshold at which either of your, I mean, Mr. Landauer, you represent many different districts, your governing bodies routinely conduct detailed cost analyses at $1 million worth of personal services, at $5 million worth of personal services? How do your governing bodies know that they are getting the lowest cost quality services now?
Chair Roblin, Representative Nolan, I think that what we do in that regard is when we go out to bid for those services, and we're just talking about the personal services, that's when we get the knowledge or the information in to determine to see what the cost comparison would be.
What is the threshold? I don't know what that threshold is. I can certainly check with many of my districts, but I suspect that it varies widely depending on sizes. We have one of the largest fire districts in the state. We have a vector control district that I'm sure you can imagine is quite small. I can't imagine that a vector control district will be letting a personnel contract out for greater than $150,000, but the disparity or difference may be very substantial depending on the size and nature of our districts. But I would be certainly happy to ask the question.
Just one final comment. Not a question. It seems to me if the testimony we're hearing is that bids on personal services contracts vary widely, that would be exactly the circumstance under which we would want people who are spending taxpayer dollars to do an analysis of whether they can get a better deal through a different mechanism of providing the services. And at some threshold, and that's why I'm interested in the threshold, I could actually understand and accept for something as big as the city of Portland, $150,000 is, you'd be doing these studies all the time. But I would like to think, and I suspect the taxpayers would like to think, that there is some threshold at which it makes sense to do exactly this kind of thing, and I'd like to know what that threshold is.
Sure.
I suspect that threshold came about related to the formal solicitation threshold. That's where you actually do a formal competitive bidding process at the $150,000 level. And so that's, and I just saw these the Dash 4 amendments yesterday afternoon for the first time. So I'm not sure what the thought was behind, but that'd be my guess.
And I'll ask one before I have Representative Edwards, going along that same line. My concern is, if you've already let bids, and that's when you could make the cost comparison analysis, how often after you've gone out for bids and put people through that process, would you then not accept one of those bids and just refuse all of them because the other is still cheaper? Is that something that happens routinely?
I would say it's not routinely, no.
Okay. Because I get concerned, as what was being said, you've already gone through this whole process, you've got this bid out there, people have put a lot of energy and time into it, and now you look at it and somebody says, I think we could do that for the same or lower prices with our own people, and you're saying, yeah, well, we've already gone through this whole process, this is the bid in front of us, this is the one we're going to take. I worry that that sets you in line to spend the extra money just because you've gone through the process, which also took a lot of money. So I the line of questioning she was having was making me a little anxious about where the chicken and the egg go and how we get to this. So I also would like to think about this, where we're at there. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't remember which one of you testified about the amount of analysis that you would have to do on the bidder's own cost structure. But so I just want to make clear, because we haven't heard this bill for quite a while in business and labor, and I've been busy with other things, and I'm just now getting caught up back up on this again. These are new amendments, so let me, for my own clarity's sake, understand that you would, by the Dash 4s, you would have to do that level, a level of cost analysis for the purposes of determining whether or not wages and benefits were the reason for a discrepancy in your own cost versus a private contractor's cost. Is that the reason that you would be required to know what the materials cost of the private bidder and the labor and et cetera, or am I missing something here?
I'm not sure if I'm following it correctly, Chair Roland, Representative Edwards. If we were to do the cost analysis, my understanding of the way this is written would be to make a determination to bring the work in-house and work with our own internal workforce, or to contract those services out. And that would be that decision point to understand.
And where you get it confused is that there is a part of the bill that says, if after you've done the cost analysis, and we set these two things side by side, and the only reason that the in-house is more expensive is because of wages and benefits, but all other factors are equal, or actually it could have been cheaper, but the wages and benefits, that alone cannot be the reason you could go out and bid it out. That's still true in this amendments. And that was part of the original bill, and I think that's what you're alluding to, and I think that's still here.
Yeah, follow up?
Yep.
So I guess what I'm wondering is, I know that is still here in the bill. The gentleman testifying right now have just testified that they may not have, particularly in I guess it was Mark's testimony, in a small district, you may not have the staff personnel to go out and do the analysis on the cost structure of the bids that you've received. And I guess, so I was leading to a follow-up question, which is, why not require the contractor to just give you that information? And I And I don't know how personal service contracts differ from, say, construction contracts, but yeah. I've handled a lot of construction contracts in the past, and I asked for a bid for the materials and supplies and the labor and yeah. and et cetera, et cetera. And so I could just look at the bid and say, well, here's what is attributable to what.
Chair Roblin and Representative Edwards, you know, that certainly may be an option to a local government, but putting myself in a private entity's shoes, I don't know if that's material that I want to provide to a public entity, first of all, because you may be competing with other employers out there in an attempt to get public contracting. You may be providing company information that may put you at a disadvantage for future contracts. That material, once you supply it to the public entity, would be public record.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
And we'll keep in touch. We're going to take a little break here because we have some members that are going to have to go, and we do have a quorum. So our other hearing is open. So we're going to go back to House Bill 3451, which is early ballot scanning, just so people know what the bill is about. And I would entertain a motion. And you can announce the – while we're getting ready for the motion, we can announce that we did get our physical and our –
We have a minimal expenditure impact statement from legislative fiscal and a no revenue impact statement from legislative revenue office on this matter. And they are at the dais, and so I believe you have all of the information that you need.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Edwards.
I move House Bill 3451 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Edwards moves House Bill 3451 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? And I guess what I want to say is that this bill is one that we are, from my perspective, helping our counties do their work more efficiently. I think it can be a bill that actually saves money over time if they can get some work done when the ballots are there. I am assured that the Secretary of State's office will carefully make sure that the systems can be and will be done in accordance that will keep the security in the place where it needs to be. I think they've shown that with the one system, the HART system, in the past, and I appreciate that that has been working. I have been convinced that there is also a way to do that for these other systems. And again, I think the idea that it has to be a plan, it is a may, not a must, all of those things are in place to make sure and recognize that I think this is one of those that a lot of people are going to be watching very, very closely. Our election process is very important to all of us, and we like to make sure that it's safe and secure. So with that, any other comments that need to be made by anyone?
Well put, Mr. Speaker. or Mr. Chair.
So with that, we'll do a roll call vote. Excused.
Representative Gilzer?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Excused.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roper?
Aye. Motion passes, and we will send that to the floor. And again, I think this is one of those that I know everybody's jumping up and down to be able to carry on the floor. I will carry the bill and explain that. So I took it away from all of you, and I know that disappoints many. So we're going to close our work session on House Bill 3451. And now we're back in our public hearing. So thank you for that, committee, for being able to take care of that. So next, if Tricia Smith, Tim Tift could come up, we'll do this in twosomes.
Absolutely, thank you.
And thank you both for being here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and we are here in support of House Bill 2867. In particular today, we would like to talk about the need and importance of a cost-benefit analysis. You've heard from Dr. Lafer of the University of Oregon as he discussed the reports and the studies that he conducted on behalf of OSEA, and I believe you have been given copies of the studies. Dr. Lafer did the first study in 2004 at our request to look at the cost of providing services through contracts that are normally provided by school employees. We, in every downturn, have a rush in school districts of contracting out services that are performed by our members ordinarily, and that is always done in the name of saving money. What our members had told us for years is that these contracts ended up costing districts more money, not saving money, and so we asked the Labor Education Research Center to conduct a study of those contracts to determine what was true. Did they cost more or were they actually saving money? They did their first study in 2004, and that was the study in blue cover that you see, and they studied, among other districts, the Lincoln County School District, which in 2003 offloaded custodial, transportation, and food service as a result of a last downturn in the economy. What Dr. Lafer found was that Lincoln County suffered a significant loss in quality of services and is paying more for those services than they did prior to contracting out. With me today is Jim Tift, who is a field representative with OSEA and was prior to that working in the Rainier School District. Attached to Mr. Tift's testimony is testimony from another of our members, Dick Volker, who works in Lincoln County. And I encourage you to read Mr. Volker's testimony. He was not able to be here today, but he lived through that contracting out experience, went to work for the contractor, and then came back to work for the district. So his firsthand account of the difference in services, I think, should be meaningful to you. When we're talking about services that our members provide in schools, these are services that maintain the health and safety of school buildings and vehicles. They maintain hygiene and sanitation, and these are very important services and need to be maintained at a much higher standard than typical commercial services of this area, whether you're talking about mass transit, compared to school districts or school buses, or if you're talking about custodial services in schools versus commercial buildings. Most professionals in commercial buildings are not putting everything in their mouth. At least they're not supposed to. Kids do. So schools must be maintained in a much higher standard than other facilities must. And you will find in Dr. Lafer's reports that many, many districts have left it to contractors to write those standards after the contracts have been let. He mentions that in his own testimony, and you will find it in both of the reports. Because the 2004 report was so significant in its findings, we asked the Labor Education and Research Center to do a second follow-up study in 2008. We wanted to know if his snapshot was an anomaly or if these were continuing problems in districts. What you find in the second study, when he looked at Lake Oswego and other districts, this is a continuing problem in schools wherever there are contracts. One of the reasons for this is because in school district contracts, we are down now to really only one company per service. For student transportation, there's a company called First Student. A couple of years ago, it ate its last competitor, which was Laidlaw. And this English multinational corporation is now essentially the single bus contractor in Oregon and in the country. We were disappointed to see local governments taken out of the transparency bill, which was 2037 and is now 2500, because one of the things Dr. Lafer found in his study was that school districts, one from another, don't know what their neighbors in the next district over are paying a contractor. So they are paying that contractor a different rate. Unfortunately, we are not included in the transparency bill. We hope you will continue to think of us and look for ways to include transparency in contracting that's done in school districts as well, so that districts have the opportunity to know whether First Student is giving them a rate that is comparable to the rate that the neighbor over on the other side of the hill got. In the meantime, we absolutely believe that if districts were required to establish their own quality standards and were required to do a cost-benefit analysis prior to contracting, they would at least know prior to contracting whether or not they were getting a good deal, whether or not what the marketing director for this multinational corporation told them will in fact play on the ground in their district. We have heard arguments on the other side, on both ends of the spectrum. We have heard that this bill is unnecessary because these cost-benefit analyses are being done, in which case I'm not sure what the problem with the bill is. And then we've heard you can't make us do this because it will cost us so much money to do this. And we're getting cut, our budgets are being cut, and it's a bad time. It is a bad time. But as Ms. Unger indicated to you, public agencies, government at all levels in Oregon is contracting literally billions of dollars of services every year in Oregon. And we don't know whether or not we're getting a good deal or a bad deal, because no one is required to make that analysis. We believe now more than ever it's important to know what you're buying before you buy it, so that if it's not the right thing to do, you can change course before it's too late. We encourage you, we appreciate the questions. We want you to know we are working with anyone who has a legitimate concern about particular language within this bill to try to clear up those concerns. But we hope that you will not lose sight of how very, very important it is that government agencies that are doing major contracting know what they're doing before they do it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Tiff. Today I'm proud to be an OSEA field representative on the Columbia River and the North Coast. Prior to taking my current position, I worked for the Rainier School District for 15 years. I was the OSEA chapter president representing the classified employees when the district decided to contract out our student transportation department and custodians. At the time, Rainier had a very stable workforce. Our bus drivers had an average of 17 years of experience, and all but four of the 21 drivers lived in the district. And between them, 32 of their children were in a student body at Rainier Schools, where their families lived, worked, and spent their money. They took pride in their jobs, their buses, and their students. They went the extra mile for safety, making sure every bus was regularly inspected, thoroughly steam cleaned the undercarriage, and inspecting the frame from front to rear. They did this even if it was not required by state regulation, because keeping equipment in top shape and our students' safety was a matter of pride. Today, I don't know what the employee experience is at the bus barn because we don't get to know each other. There's no communication between district staff and the drivers anymore. We still have seven of the original 21 drivers who were with the transportation when it was contracted out. One of those drivers tells me she's only received a 75-cent raise in the last 5 years. You'd think since they aren't paying their drivers, they could afford to pay the district for the buildings and grounds they occupy. But that's not so. They lease the building and grounds from the district for $1 a year. This includes utilities and the upkeep and the maintenance of the buildings and the grounds. And then when Rainier contracted out the custodial service, they got a janitorial service instead of a custodial service. Custodians do more than clean. They perform general maintenance, they paint, they move furniture, replace ceiling tiles, change out light bulbs, make minor electrical and plumbing repairs. They help repair the playground equipment and assist with anything that needs to be done in their schools. I recall one of our custodians worked outside all one summer assisting in painting the building, saving the district over $80,000. Today, the janitors will not change a light bulb if it's over 10 feet off the ground. Rather than taking the furniture to a storage where it's needed to be stored, they move it into the hallways. The maintenance crews now move the furniture the rest of the way to the storage areas. If they're asked to do anything besides superficial cleaning, the district will receive an extra charge. We've had two contractors in Rainier in the last 6 years since the district contracted out the custodial service. Just like the bus driver, we lost seasoned professionals with an average of 14 years experience. Now there seems to be a revolving door with the staff. Of the 7 custodians who work with the district, only 2 live inside the district. Our student body have 2 students from the custodial service where we had 7 prior. And before the school district contracted out transportation and custodial services, they were told they'd get more for less. What really happened is they've got less for more. House Bill 2867 will put requirements in place that will help prevent this kind of waste of the sacred education dollar and destruction of careers in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for these 2 witnesses? Seeing none, thank you both. Next, is there Mike Eelson from Association of Oregon Counties? Thank you. I think I had you up before, but we've got you there now. So, and Angie Peterman, Oregon School Board Business Officials. Okay. She's welcome when she gets here, so someone's going to get her. So we'll start with yours. Thank you. Sorry we missed you last time.
Oh, no, it's okay. I was actually out of the room, and my fault.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Michael Elias, and I'm Policy Manager with the Association of Oregon Counties. Be really brief. I'm just now coming to this issue reviewed the Dash 4 amendments today. We at the Association of Oregon Counties, we support efforts to improve the public procurement process. We do have some concerns with this bill. And just want it to be known that we're ready to work with the proponents of the bill to try to make it a little bit better. We have some concerns about adding layers of administrative bureaucracy, basically, and potential costs associated with that. But there are things in this bill that are good ideas that we would like to be a part of the discussion. There are a few specific parts of the bill that we do have some concerns about, but I think you've already heard about those from other folks. So just wanted it to be on the record that while we oppose the bill as it is now, we do think there are good ideas in there that we'd like to be part of working on.
Okay.
Thank you.
Questions for Mike? Thank you very much.
Thanks.
We're waiting for Angie. Let's go with John Rakowitz. I've got these 2. I want to end with those possibles.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is John Rakowitz with AGC Public Affairs Director. I'll be brief. I'm speaking to a different section of the bill, Chair Roblin, members of the committee, and that is the section that SEIU referred to under their goals number 4 that expands responsible bidder guidelines to ensure that contractors have a satisfactory record of performance and integrity. Obviously, we're in favor of that. We also just received the amendments today. We want to take a look at the language, make sure it's workable. But we're very pleased to be working with, and we've had an excellent working relationship with SEIU. That's why I put down my position as neutral until we actually understand the language. We just want to be careful and meticulous. I will also applaud the SEIU and the proposers of this bill, the others, that the scope of this bill originally was so broad that we were not able to support it. So we're moving over to the support side. But I want to point out something. I'm less than a year into this job, and when this bill came out a couple of months ago, I went to the file cabinet, and I found an entire file cabinet that there was 4 years of work on public contracting rewrite that was concluded in 2003. And one of the reasons that I think the bill has been so improved is it's narrowed its scope. And the scope now is it's separated out, whereas before it was commingling the procurement side of public contracting, which is a fundamentally different kind of endeavor, and it was commingling that with capital construction, and that's no longer true. And I think that's part of the struggle here. I've talked to a few folks that were involved in this, and it was a four-year effort to rewrite the code. We have a good code now, and we just want to make sure that whatever happens beyond this one section I'm speaking to right now, the dash four, in the expanded responsible bidder guidelines, that we honor all that work that went on. It was four long years, and I have the files to prove it. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? I guess my one question is that on the responsible bidding part, I have watched a number of different groups struggle with the idea of how do I write a contract. We know we want to get this project done at the best we can, and we know that the overriding thing is the low bid. It just seems to dominate all these boards, and so they get this low bid and they don't know what to do other than to accept the low bid. Yeah. Even though they're uncomfortable with doing it, they think that that's the number one criteria, and if they overrule it, they get hurt. Do you think this is helping get to those kinds of issues?
Well, my understanding is that it's not only the low bid, it is also the responsible bid.
I know.
And it is also, and that's what these criteria are about, and it is also the responsive bid, which goes back to the type of specifications that are put in the request for proposals. So the world of public contracting is, I've done a lot of it from the government side. And so I know actually more about it from that side of the equation. It's one of the most complex endeavors that government can undertake. Earlier today, somebody from the city testified to the DOJ's model rules. That was a result of the 2003 four-year-long effort. So I'm just urging caution because there was so much work put into that if we in fact have a bill up this session, AGC does, trying to include OUS and other governments having to follow those same procedures. So we're all about one fair, understandable playing field that meets the responsibility, the responsiveness, and certainly the low cost, because everybody wants to get the biggest bang for the buck. So I think the underlying law as it's written is one of the better products in the country, is my understanding, and that the DOJ rules that are out there, model rules, really make it possible for agencies of all sizes. On the side that doesn't have to do with construction, we're talking about hundreds of contracting out public agencies. So you have all sizes and shapes with all types of services. So those basic rules and the statutes and everything provide a good foundation. Then you get into the element of what you're talking about is the specific contract, the specific project. And so I think that's why it can get so muddled so quickly. So hopefully I've been helpful answering your question.
Thank you. Any other questions? None? Thank you very much.
You.
So I think we've got all those. Did Angie Peterman make it back? Have we seen Angie? Nope. So we have Cameron McGinnis and is it Jolie Davis. Okay. Whichever one wants to go first.
My name is Cameron McGinnis. I work for the Oregon Department of Transportation at Meacham, which is a snow zone on Interstate 84 between LeGrand and Pendleton. I am also the president of the ODOT Local 730, which is the represented part of the represented members of the ODOT that are in SEIU. My members are part of the reason why SEIU got involved with this issue and brought this forward. When I first went to work in 1993 for ODOT, I was on a crew with a lot of folks with 15 and 20 years in. Meacham, even though it's insignificant and not on all state maps, was the center of the Region 5 Eastern Oregon paving crew. And so the actual crew at Meacham was like five folks, but the paving crew was headquartered out of there, and there were 25 or 30 members who came, and they did everything from crush the rock, they'd procure the oil and make their own asphalt, and literally ODOT and those folks that I learned under paved the roads, the same roads that I was plowing snow on when I came on as a seasonal. And so I think part of the reason why I bring that up is I think part of the reason why we're where we're at is the folks that I came into, that I came to work for, were this, and taught me some of the things that I know. Obviously, they, in a couple of years, they couldn't teach me 25 and 30 years worth of what they knew. Those people that I worked for were the same people whose hands built the road. And as we've specialized and got into the contracting side of things, the people like myself who are on the road and building the highway, we're getting farther and farther from the work. And in the same way that my mentors built the road, the folks that Joel represents, they inspected the road. And now we're to the place where we talked about design and build contracts, where not only do Joel's members not design the road, but quite often they don't inspect them. And so the members on the actual highway sections, the folks that do the work, were farther and farther and farther from the building and from the contracting and from the inspecting. And so my members are concerned because in the old days we built the road, so if there was something wrong with it, we didn't have anybody to blame but ourselves. Now there are sections of the road that are rebuilt and changed, and we're not even asked. And so I don't know that this bill is going to correct all of these kinds of things, but we wanted to at least have a conversation, start a conversation, and see if we can sort of bring everything together. The kinds of stories that my members bring to me, everyone in the room has sat at a traffic light at some time or another. And then some of the new traffic lights, if you watch them, and you're sitting there waiting to go, you see them, they sort of flicker a little bit. Well, our electricians know what's required to have a good traffic signal. But they're not consulted anymore and quite often they're contracted out. And that's fine. But what they know is that the circuit boards that are now, they all used to be mechanical and hardwired. The circuit boards that are now put in them, they're not soldered circuit boards, if that means anything to anybody that has electrical background. Our electricians know they have to be soldered, because when they're crimped and extruded, you get traffic rumbling by there all day long, and all those extrusions come loose. And so if you ever on by and there's an ODOT truck sitting there with the rotor beam going, and there's a guy sitting on a little stool with his head inside a cabinet, that work has been done on contract, and the contract has been satisfied, and they've done everything, and our ODOT folks are spending hours out there, and there's no room or way or method to go back to the contractor and have them fix it. So our folks are sitting in there with their head in the cabinet soldering all those connections on those panels. About 10 years ago, Cabbage Hill, which is the hill leaving Pendleton and going east towards La Grande, it has a bit of a reputation. It was rebuilt pretty much from the base up. And I was the member representative of the section who was assigned to the engineers, to ODOT's engineers, who were inspecting the project. And one of my areas of responsibility were the striping crews. And the striping crew, there were contract crews. They got used to me being around there after a couple of months, and they were probably less than careful about their conversations. We had just finished striping the eastbound side going up, and every week they don't get paid their whole contract at the beginning or at the end. They file weekly reports of their work progress, and they're paid as those weekly reports go in. The foreman on the job came back, and he was particularly excited that day. The payment for finishing the eastbound side paid all of their materials, labor, and mobilization and demobilization costs for the whole contract. Every progress report they got paid for on the westbound side was above their actual cost to do the work. I think that goes to Representative Edwards' questions about why not do cost analysis, and if necessary, why not ask the contractor to provide the cost analysis. No one knew what the cost of that job was, and fully by more than 100%. The cost of striping that hill was what we paid. Today, I am here away from my section on Highway 395 right now today, 30 miles south of Pendleton near mile marker 36. There's been a slide caused by excess water. They estimate the slide is being 20,000 cubic yards, and we've been working 7 days a week, 15 and 16 hours a day to remove the slide, and today hopefully we're going to start filling the slide back in. That section of 395 was rebuilt on contract just 2 or 3 years ago. And to sort of tie all the things that I've talked about together, where the maintenance crews and our own in-house engineers are farther and farther from the contract, when that was done, there was a culvert there, and when they went through that portion of the road, it was in the summertime, and many of you know what the hills around Pendleton look like. They're pretty bare. And they didn't see the reason or the justification for the culvert that our forebears put in there several generations ago, and so they decided to abandon it. The locals know that the hill that that part of road on is the best grass for cows, literally for miles. Right there where the slide occurred, there's a willow grove, not the big, tall, old-fashioned ones, but the shrub willows that thrive there year-round. And so when they covered and abandoned that culvert, the water from those underground springs that have been there since before man was there and built up, and finally it liquefied the soil and it flowed away. So in some ways, the three examples that I'm providing you today don't have a thing to actually do with the nitty-gritty of what's in this bill. But it has everything to do with why my members ask for us to have this conversation and to start this bill down the road. The last 20 or 30 years have changed completely how we build roads and who it is that builds them. And the communication between the folks that are designing and planning and inspecting the roads just isn't there anymore the way it used to be. And we feel, as the stewards of that resource, that we have a responsibility to say something and to get something started and to make things better and not watch our assets kind of waste away. And I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you.
Thank you
very much.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today to present testimony in favor of improved public contracting as written and amended in HB 2867. My name is Joelle Davis, and I serve as the co-executive director of the Association of Engineering Employees of Oregon. We're a public employees union of nearly 1,100 members comprised of engineers and professional staff at the State Departments of Transportation, Parks, and Forestry. Our independent union has been organized for over 60 years, since 1948. HB 2867 allows contracting agencies to use past performance data when considering who to grant contracts to. We believe that this will help solve the problem of contractors who routinely low-bid contracts only to jack up their prices to sometimes more than double the original bid through constant change orders that are generated by the contractor and not by the agency, in addition to filing improper claims and irresponsible construction methods resulting in delays and poor product, as Cam was able to tell us. You'll remember how this was recently highlighted when the Ross Brothers firm was found to have filed more than $3.1 million in largely bogus construction claims on an Ontario Bridge project from 2001. The partners in the firm actually bet each other a dollar to see who could get these false claims funded through the contracting agency the fastest. Problems like this don't happen with every contractor, but there's no way under current law to deal with the bad apples. State contracting laws currently allow public contracts to be overseen by the contractors themselves. That means that contractors can provide their own inspection and oversight of their own projects, which is like putting the fox in charge of watching the hen house. HB 2867 will help put an end to this by requiring public construction projects to use independent inspectors and independent oversight. There's more savings to be had through better practices, cost-benefit analysis, and use of available resources. A recent study from the University of Oregon of 72% of bridge projects from 1997 to 2008 showed that ODOT could have saved $27 million had they used in-house design engineers. This study fits with findings from the Oregon Secretary of State, whose 2006 audit showed that the state could have saved upwards of 20% of its cost through using in-house engineers during the design process. HB 2867 promotes a more responsible method for determining what work is contracted out and what work stays in-house by requiring cost-benefit analysis and proper oversight. Our members are dedicated workers and taxpayers as well, who get so frustrated when they see their tax dollars taken advantage of by contractors who game the system. If we don't enact strong standards and accountability now, we'll all continue to lose money and build projects that are less safe and require replacement quicker than they should. So that's why the members of AEE support the passage of HB 2867. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for either of these two witnesses? Thank you both for being here. Appreciated the stories. Is there anyone else who would like to testify? Come on, Angie, it's okay. And is there anybody else that's here who didn't sign up who would like to testify? So.
My apologies, Chair Roland and members of the committee. I had no idea that I would be quite as long as it turned out that I was at the other hearing. So, my name is Angie Peterman. I am the Executive Director for the Oregon Association of School Business Officials. And our association works with school business officials all over the state. I've had lots of experience with district operational issues as a school business official as well for about 15 years prior to serving as exec director. With regard to 2867, I have some concerns and some of my members have some concerns with regard to some of the language dealing with the cost analysis, feasibility studies that would have to be done in conjunction with looking at contracting out of services. Districts generally have probably a somewhat informal process of looking at trying to estimate what the cost of providing a service internally is versus looking at having it provided externally. Our bid and statutory requirements, I think, are pretty clear as to when we have to go through a formal bid process, what that process involves, where we don't have statute that addresses some of the things that concerns that I've heard and seen within 2867. I believe that we have administrative rule that does and or board policy that does. Doesn't mean that we still don't find ourselves certainly experiencing unhappy results, I guess, from these processes. But our primary concern has to do with the fact that we believe this language would prohibit districts from being able to contract any services under any circumstance, that it would be very expensive for districts to go through the process of trying to do the feasibility study or cost analysis that's required in Section 4. Most districts do not have staff on board that would be able to provide that service necessarily, and so we'd be looking at either contracting, again, that service to an outside source or trying to hire internally staff, which could be cost prohibitive. I suspect in order to track the costs, including indirect costs, that we'd be looking at some pretty significant outlay of cash as well for potentially software upgrades and those kinds of things. And the part that probably was most troubling is not that we would need to be able to demonstrate that it was cost effective to the district to do contracting, because I believe that districts generally are looking at being cost effective in that process. One of the things that I found most troubling and that others in the organization have concern over is the fact that if the cost savings were based upon savings from salary and benefit as opposed to other savings, supplies, materials, equipment, and so forth, we'd be precluded from doing contracting of those services. Well, if we're being frugal and reasonable in our procurement processes, as we should be, to acquire those products and services and equipment, fuel, those kinds of things, if we're dealing with buses or something else, then it seems to me that where we're generally going to see the potential for savings is in the area of salaries and benefits. And it seems an unreasonable expectation that we wouldn't be looking at salary and benefit costs as potential savings areas. So certainly those were, I think, some of the biggest concerns that we've had. You know, it would very likely require that we redirect revenues that are already limited to doing these cost studies and so forth, in hopes of being able to show and demonstrate that it was appropriate to go forward with the bid process. Not sure that that accomplishes what any of us are out to accomplish, and certainly restricting our ability to contract because the savings are primarily in the area or strictly in the area of salary and benefit seems to fly in the face of things that we're trying to do as far as being prudent and reasonable with our resources these days.
Okay. Thank you. We'll go for both first.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Marshall Koba, here today representing the American Council of Engineering Companies of Oregon. We have about 110 members representing about 3,000 private sector engineering engineers in Oregon. To the bill of House Bill 2867, we have some concerns about the bill. We've just seen it recently, and we continue to review that. But I think some of the comments that were made today have kind of compelled me to come up here and make a few comments. But we're pleased to see the commitment from 2867 to the best use of public funds. And this leads directly into an issue that the engineering profession has pushed for the past several decades at the federal, state, and local levels of government, which is called QBS, or Qualification-Based Selection. QBS is the procurement process for architectural and engineering services that is required by the federal government, the state of Oregon, and in Oregon local government projects that meet a threshold of $900,000 and also include 10% of state money in some sort of a grant or direct payment that are included in a project. While not in this bill or amendments, QBS shows, I think, our commitment to the wise, efficient, and appropriate use of public funds. And QBS is endorsed by the American Bar Association, the American Public Works Association, and ensures our members are held to a higher level of scrutiny, ensuring quality design, quality projects, and the efficient use of public funds through the construction phase and the entire life cycle of whatever project it may be. And as we all know, in buildings or other things, it can be 50, 60, 70 years. Mr. Chair, I hope your water board used QBS, qualification-based selection, when selecting the designer for your dam that you were hoping was earthquake ready. I set that background because I'd like to take a moment to comment on Dr. Lafer's report. The time frame he studied was a unique time frame, I think, for ODOT and for Oregon in that they used a unique process to design the projects with the major bridge repair projects that came out in the bridge package, I think, was passed in 2001 or 2003 for a couple billion dollars. The ODOT used a process resulting in the bridge delivery partners, which is a unique process that was new to ODOT at the time, and I don't think it's a process that is expected to be replicated if we were to move forward with the package this session. In addition, this is the second hearing that Dr. Lafer has made comments about the savings potentially from in-house versus contracting out the design services. When I asked him for his report following the last hearing, he said it wasn't final. And this is about a month later. I have still yet to see a final report for us to have an opportunity to review it for accuracy. We have a very good relationship with the Department of Transportation in Oregon. We work well with them. We meet with them regularly on a regular basis. And I just wanted to put that on the record. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for either of these witnesses? I guess the biggest part for me with contracting, I sat on a team in contracting out in a school district. And one of the things that was clear to me, especially in the contracting out for custodial, that getting apples and oranges was almost impossible. Because the contract would say we provide these services, and then you said as a principal sitting there, well, does it cost me more if I have to set up the gym to do XYZ? Yes, it costs you more. I mean, and I have a basketball game on Thursday night. I mean, by the time they put all the additives in, it was a different contract than the one that they were looking at. So I think it's important that we do some of the things that were talked about earlier, and that is clearly describe what we're trying to ask for.
Right.
because sometimes that's where the apple and oranges comparison go, and this one looks a lot cheaper. But in the long run, by the time you pay all the overtime and other things to get things to happen the way they've always happened, you find that you have missed the boat. And the flexibility of having your own staff and their understanding of how the system works can be very, very helpful. So I just want to make sure that we end up getting things and they really do end up having savings or not savings. So I would talk to you more about some of the other kinds of issues with respect to that as time goes on. But I appreciate your comments because I think, so anyway, any comments to that?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I agree completely that, you know, we want to make sure in this process of looking at contracting a service versus maintaining a service internally that we clearly identify and delineate what it is that that service is. And from the district's perspective, we have to be very, very clear as to what it is that we're seeking in the way of service, and then we have to very clearly look at and evaluate what those other hidden costs may be or what those other miscellaneous kinds of items are that we didn't think about, like setting up the gym or, you know, looking at, because the custodial staff, when we hired them, did that setup, and now with a contract they don't. And so it's obviously incumbent upon districts to be very, very clear as to what those expectations are and to make sure that the documents that we prepare in requesting a bid be very, very clear in delineating those things. I'm not sure that we have to go to the extent that is prescribed within at least part of 2867 to accomplish that.
Okay. Any other questions? I thought this might be a little shorter, but we always fill up the time we're allotted. It's always so exciting.
Especially if you have to wait.
So thank you both. And is there any other discussion? We're going to close the public hearing on 2867. And committee, I appreciate your attentiveness and your willingness to be here every time till 5. See you on Wednesday. We're going to... Yeah, no Friday meeting. So, again, thank you, and we're going to close our...
You have to let me know if you actually get those calls.
...session and the rules today. Thank you.
Vancouver Day yesterday?